So from this point of view, Gandhi, like a mother fasting for the good of her children, is well-intentioned but misguided. The Jain fast must certainly not be directed to some other purpose outside the self. Indeed, even to say that it is aimed at achieving spiritual purification or enlightenment is somewhat problematical. Progress towards achieving purification and enlightenment involves, among other things, the diminishing of all capacity for desire, dislike, or fear. So although the fast must begin as a very definite act of volition, a public declaration of intention and the adoption of a vow, as the fast proceeds, this volition should ideally be extinguished. As the Jain texts invariably put it, having taken the vow and embarked upon the fast, one waits without eagerness for its conclusion. This distinctive pattern of volition and agency is also one of the features that marks the Jain Samadhi Maran from the well-known practice of sati, the immolation of a widow on her husband's funeral pyre. In the early decades of the 19th century, notably, the practice was outlawed by the then British government in India. The prohibition of sati was one of a number of issues around the rights and treatment of women in Indian society that became the focus of debate about the nature and purposes of colonial rule, and at the same time about the content of quote-unquote Indian tradition. Who had the right to say what that tradition consisted of? What right in particular did a foreign government have to regulate and reform quote-unquote traditional practices? The decision to outlaw sati was justified by those to whom it was justified, basically on two arguments. First, British commentators, and even more energetically, Indian reformers, contended that instances of sati were not genuine expressions of the Indian tradition. The unfortunate women who died in this way, burned on their husbands' funeral pyres, were, they claimed, coerced by unscrupulous in-laws who wanted to be rid of a now superfluous female dependent. So they were really cases of murder dressed up in religious finery. And secondly, prohibition was justified for those for whom it was justified on the grounds that sati was anyway a barbaric corruption of tradition. It was late and inauthentic. Often this was expressed by saying that it arose from Muslim influence. Prohibition was therefore restitution and return to an imagined authentic Hindu tradition. So argued those for the prohibition. Supporters of the practice argued, by contrast, that the superficial materialist viewpoint of Westerners and Westernized elites blinded them to the true spiritual beauty of the widow's goddess-like courage and devotion. The foreigners and reformers could see only self-interest, only material interest, because that was all their own worldview allowed for. And anyway, this show of protecting Indian women from Indian men was transparently an apologia for colonial rule, a presumptuous and paternalistic claim to understand a religious tradition better than those who lived by it. It's interesting that these arguments were revived almost entirely unaltered in the 1980s and 1990s with the rise of the Hindu right to political prominence in India. The secularist, post-independence, more or less socialist Congress governments had continued and indeed strengthened the prohibition on sati introduced by the British colonial government, along with the prohibition in Indian law of all forms of suicide. Hindu revivalists, as they gained political power in the 80s and 90s, portrayed this continuation of colonial legal tradition as an instance of what they called internal colonialism. It was, they said, evidence of the extent to which India's rulers were now foreign in outlook, if no longer actually in blood. Controversy focused especially around a particular instance where sati occurred in rural Rajasthan, in a village not far from where I did fieldwork, in 1987. The husband of a very young and recently married Hindu couple died, and his widow, a woman called Rup Kanwar, was burned to death hours later on his funeral pyre. photographs purporting to show the event began to circulate in nearby towns. And almost immediately, huge crowds started to gather in the village for ceremonies that would celebrate the event and establish a temple and cult on the site. One of the largest and most wealthy Hindu temples in the region, in an otherwise small and out-of-the-way place, commemorates a supposedly similar event which occurred in the 18th century. So those wishing to establish the temple had reason to think that success lay before them. Opposition to the establishment of a new temple commemorating what they regarded as the murder of an innocent young woman was led by women's groups in the nearby city of Jaipur, who organized a march and took action in the courts to compel the government in Delhi to enforce the law. They persuaded the central government to make aiding the sati a capital offense in union law. It already was in theory in state-level law, but this was not enforced. And in addition, they took action in the courts to outlaw the glorification of sati. The dead woman's in-laws went into hiding. They, of course, it was who had organized the thing. Local police organized a rather ostentatiously half-hearted attempt to find them, and huge counter-demonstrations were organized by regional and national Hindu revivalist groups, complaining of the suppression of authentic Hindu religious tradition by mentally foreign elite women. The radical women's groups who campaigned on the issue found themselves recapitulating exactly the arguments of their British and Indian reformist forebears in the colonial debates of nearly two centuries before. In particular, in an attempt to avoid the accusations of neocolonialism, they found themselves arguing on their opponent's terrain about the proper interpretation of Hindu mythological texts and about what were the oldest and therefore the most authoritative strata of such texts. They found themselves casting around for priests and holy men who would support their position that sati is a late and corrupt practice. They were, of course, always unlikely to win an argument of this kind, as they were conducting it on terms to which they were themselves not fundamentally committed. But more importantly, the argument they really wanted to engage in was a completely different one. They were convinced that the girl had in fact been murdered. Her death was not justifiable because it was not really suicide. Although they demanded the application of the law, which prohibits suicide, as well as any actions to facilitate or celebrate it, they did so not principally from a conviction that suicide itself is wrong, about which they had various opinions, but probably on the whole leaned towards a modern toleration of it, but because they believed that the case was really not one of suicide, but of the denigration, exploitation, and murder of women as women. Proving this meant rejecting as fabrication all the evidence that aligned Rup Kanwar's death with the established iconography of the religious practice of sati. The claim that the pyre ignited simultaneously when she took her place upon it and announced her determination to accompany her husband to heaven. The images of her sitting serenely in the fire, cradling his head on her lap, and so on. All of this, they had to contend, was fabrication. And this is what they largely concentrated on, collecting testimony that the girl was drugged to subdue her and or tied to the pyre, and or that she tried to run away and was forced back into the flames. Much of the iconography these women were seeking to refute here is similar to that of the Jain practice of Samadhimurra, since they share the underlying idea of extraordinary virtue being able to will and regulate the manner of its own death, as well, so that the self-ignition of the pyre is parallel to the self-cracking of the skull in the Jain case, as well as the imagery of purifying death by sacrificial burning. And in fact, many of the memorials to Jains who have committed Samadhimurra, who have fasted to death, especially those of women, closely resemble those of memorial stones to satis in Rajasthan. The difference is that, certainly to a sceptical and secular sensibility, the Jain practice gives much more persuasive authentication that death really is the person's own free choice and agency. This is probably why, so far as I know, the legal prohibition of suicide has never led to police or court intervention to prevent a Jane fast to death, although they're frequently very well publicised as they proceed, and on the face of it would be straightforwardly illegal. In the furious debates around Sati, and especially around Rup Kanwar's death in 1987, several commentators did draw attention to the Jain practice, and among the supporters of Sati, cited this as evidence of the hypocrisy of the secular elite that was opposing it. The fact that the woman who did more than any other to push the campaign for criminal action to be taken against Rup Kanwar's family was herself a secular Jain no doubt perverts some of this comment. But anyway, it was not very sustained, both sides probably being aware that the majority of Jains took the side of the traditionalists rather than the reformers. Insofar as the general immunity from legal and political attack on the Jain practice does derive from the fact that there's little doubt of the agency of the person undertaking it, since it's a long, drawn out, exceedingly calm and undramatic, but nevertheless very public spectacle presided over by religious teachers. Insofar as all this is the case, it is rather ironical, because from the Jain point of view, the agency of the person committing suicide in this way is, as we have seen anyway, crucially equivocal. They begin as an agent and as an agent in an act of volition, but the kind of agency they acquired by the time they finish the fast must be one which is consonant with what, from our standpoint, looks like a state of extreme passivity. They remain willing their own death, but in a state of no longer having the desire even for it to be accomplished. And it can be qualified, the kind of idea of agency we find in this fasting to death can be qualified in two further ways, which, and this is my final remarks, I'll briefly just describe. First, like the suicides of condemned aristocrats in Republican Imperial Rome, agency can be limited to choosing only the manner of one's death, where one has no choice about the fact and little about the timing of it. In Jaipur, there are at least three shrines in Jain temples dedicated to a much admired nun called Vichakshan Sriji, who died there in the early 1980s. In her 60s, she contracted breast cancer. She decided to refuse all medical treatment in defiance of the pleas of her followers and the advice of her doctors. She declared to her followers that her illness was the result of her own former bad actions, her own bad karma. She would have to endure the consequences of this sooner or later, since only in that way could she free her soul from its effects. So she actively accepted the symptoms of her disease and the no doubt excruciating pain that went with it, as if it were a voluntary austerity. She took to sitting all day in a meditational posture, telling her rosary, and asking her followers to be pleased for her, since every moment of pain she endured in this way was progress towards her own enlightenment and liberation. For her to take a final vow to fast to death for her last few days as she did was only a minor development from this publicly stated position. Vichakshan Sriji took the fact that she was going to die and the pain her disease gave rise to, and so to speak consecrated that suffering by shaping it to the template of Jain religious suicide. In this way, to some degree, she made something that happened to her, the fact that she became terminally ill, into something that she did. That's to say, she appropriated it to that concept of agency I've just described. No doubt at a terrible personal cost. This, together with the fact that she was a woman, of course accentuated the similarity to Sati in the minds of her followers, and this is reflected in the iconography. In devotional pictures, as in the statues, she is always shown seated in meditation, and unlike almost all other Jain religious representations, she is shown in a remarkably individualized and realistic fashion. Almost all other Jain sacred representations show the dead saint as a young person in full health. There have been many Jain saints in history before, many female saints, and some of them of very high categories. But she is the first to be represented as such, and the first to be represented as a very definite and individual frail old woman. A further and even more comprehensive way in which the agency of the dying person in this fast may be circumscribed arises in what is probably a relatively recent innovation, an aspect of the general Protestantizing tendency I mentioned above, for formerly monastic practices to be increasingly laicized. I've explained why it's so important in Jainism that the last few minutes of a person's life be spent in as peaceful a mental state as possible, and ideally in a state of meditational tranquility. Samadhi Marin, fasting to death, is the canonical way to ensure this. So much indeed is it part of the moral and religious imagination of lay Jains that it has become a practice to, as it were, administer the vow to terminally ill patients, even if they have not trained themselves up through a pious and strict conventional regimen of fasting and so forth. In a not entirely orthodox, but entirely understandable extension of this line of reasoning, family members these days will sometimes call in a Jain renouncer and ask him or her to administer the vow, even to an unconscious dying person, so that he or she will, in some sense, meet death as nearly as possible in an ideal state. Even though the patient might never know that he's taken the vow, so the sense in which this one can be an exercise of volition and agency is peculiarly attenuated. Thank you.
Thank you, James Naylor, for a most interesting talk, I'm sure you all agree. Very familiar to me, because when I was in India, and first time in 1999, there was a case of sati, of widower. And the arguments that James went through regarding extent of agency of the widow, whether she was coerced into burning herself, the form of coercion as well is a social expectation, a form of coercion, for example. Arguments about gender as well, very very important, and they were repeated word for word. So I think. It has become almost a ritual to repeat these arguments whenever there is. If I'm not mistaken, there was another case of sati in Rajasthan very recently. So although widow burning sounds like obsolete or old-fashioned to people looking at India from the outside, in India it's still a very real issue.
And India it's probably revived in the last.
Absolutely, week. Probably part and parcel of the Hindu nationalists, of course. I was also very interested in what you said about extent of control over one's death. Quite a common feature of Indian holy men and women. Satya Sai Baba, for example, has told his follower. Satya Sai Baba is possibly the most famous contemporary holy man. Millions, literally millions of followers. He's the type of man who gets an elephant as a birthday present. And he has told his followers that he will gracefully give up his soul in I think when he's 85 or something like that. And I was always very puzzled at this. I asked him, so is this suicide? And he said, no, it's not suicide. It's he will sit down, he will go into a kind of, not exactly a trance, but a kind of sleep. Self-induced sleep, and he will gracefully give up his soul. So the idea of control, of agency over one's death, is, I think, a very strong aspect which, as you said, I mean, I'm not very qualified to talk about this, but I think it is in distinction to our Western idea of lack of control over death. I seem to vaguely remember my late grandmother telling me about some opera della buona morte in Valletta. It was some form of devotion, whereby through certain actions, for example, charity or something like that, I don't know the exact details of this, but you would bag yourself a good death. But of course, this good death was entirely with God's grace, so one had absolutely no agency over this. as you said, in the case of euthanasia, it is simply an extension of the secular belief that if one is lucky, one dies a swift death. I think enough said on that. We have about 20 minutes for questions, and I would invite questions from the floor. Yes, there's a run here suddenly, there's a lady. Yes.
Hello, James. I'm not sure this is working. Is it? Well, thank you for a very rich talk. So I have to freewheel a little bit until I find my question. But I want to come back to this analogy with Christianity that even Mark has alluded to. Now, I realize that for the purposes of your argument today, the analogy was, I think, purely illustrative. However, there might be some other points of analogy to be made that might be productive or might not be. I really am not sure. One is that Christianity does not just have martyrdom as a kind of death which has a special relationship with God. There is also mortification, celebrated or commemorated or practiced particularly during Lent, but it is really an apprenticeship over one's lifetime. The idea of a vow is also interesting in Christianity, inasmuch as vows made to God, I'm not talking about specific vows, but especially the sacramental vows, and particularly confirmation, are not associated, to my knowledge, so much with an opening up of the person, although there is also a discourse of opening oneself up to God. But really, confirmation is a sealing of the spirit inside one. One might also say, draw some points of similarities or contrast with Islam, where, for example, a mujahid, a martyr, is someone who dies in a military war. However, the greater jihad is the struggle one fights over oneself, where the greatest jihad is that on one's heart, then there is the one over one's tongue. So a jihad can be fought with one's heart, or with one's heart rather, with one's tongue and with one's hands, that is to say, writing or with one's work, and not just with military arms.
Yeah.
Now, I believe that the distinctiveness, or one cannot explore the distinctiveness of these two religions with respect to these points, unless one looks at their own internal theories of language and their own internal theories of symbolic violence. Mm-hmm. For example, and this is where I will now try to hone down on one point, the broken vow in Christianity is an interesting point of entry for an analyst, because it is, on the one hand, the occasion of great remorse. It is the reenactment of a treachery. Nonetheless, it is also the occasion of an intimacy with God that previously might not have been there. It is an internal drama that St. Paul in the scriptures tries to explain in terms of the string connecting oneself with God, or the rope being cut, but the knot to tie it back makes the rope shorter. That conclusion of the ramble. I was wondering whether you thought that the internal, if there was an internal theory, internal to Jainism, theory of symbolic violence as opposed to non-violence, and whether you thought it might be relevant.
I'm not sure that I can think immediately of an analogy to the kind of instance you've just given. Well, except, of course, that similarly with breaking vows, there is an idea that the experience of doing so is educative. There's not the idea that it can results in a closer relationship to God, and that's because of the essential absence in Jainism of a present personal God. That's one of the reasons I think that the account of what happens as the person approaches purification is so much a matter of relationship simply to the self. So that means that accounts of in religious idiom of symbolic violence are always about violence on the self and to the self, the ways in which apparently pleasurable or enjoyable activities are always regarded as violence on the self, and you have to distinguish and come to see that they are violence on the self, and that the things which do good to the self are indeed the things that look at first sight like violence.
The lady at the front, I think, had a point to make. And then... I'm assuming Ranier is finished with
this. Yes. Yes.
Thanks.
Would you call this preparation for death a ritual of the Jainists? Would you call it a ritual?
I would say that it is fairly ritualized, yeah.
And you also believe that a ritual is non-intentional?
In some respects, yes.
And you said the will to die of these people, mm-hmm. and the will, although not so connected with the verb to intend, mm-hmm. to intend, mm-hmm. Isn't there intention, therefore, if
Absolutely.
One wills to die? And this is intention in a ritual. Mm-hmm. So ritual is not always non-intentional.
The argument about ritual, you'll recall, is that... The argument I make about ritual, you will recall, is that the identity of the actions within it are not a result of the intentions of
yes,
the participants.
And other questions which I'm going to ask
that's
tomorrow.
Fine. And therefore, in that sense, it's non-intentional. I think I emphasized, I thought I'd rather gone on about it and repeated myself, in fact, that that doesn't mean that the action is unintentional or that there are not intentions.
Yes, exactly. Because I found a whole regiment of intentions in a ritual.
As I would expect.
But then, at the end of it, there is that non-intentional, which I shall mention tomorrow.
Thanks. We'll have...
And which I think will also please that man.
I have a question. Because
he was yesterday. He was greatly interested in intention. You remember how you struggled with intention in ritual?
Thank you. I have a question at the back, I believe, or is it Dr. Glau?
In a sense, I'd like to follow up a train of thought. Which one you're initiated. It has to do with the whole issue of volition, which you focused on toward the end. I wasn't quite clear about the transition from volition to passivity. Renier was discussing types of vow and possibilities of broken vow in Christian discourse.
Mm-hmm.
What I was not quite clear on is how in the fasting to death you begin with volition to initiate the act, but you end without volition. And I'm just playing on a difference here.
I think
between
what I was trying to
my
say
understanding
is that
of Jainism and Christianity.
I think what I was trying to say is that in the Jain thought is that you can develop a form of action which is volitional but not involving desire. And that's, as it were, a concept of a kind of volition that you can end up with in religious action, which I think to us seems paradoxical and slightly difficult to understand. But that's the idea they're trying to arrive. That's the objective that this practice can be seen as an instantiation of.
Does this suggest that for the Jain, will is associated with desire? that will and the act of will, volition, agent, the whole sphere of agency is associated
generally
with desire or matter rather than with the soul or emptiness?
Yes, the answer is generally, but they hope to reach a state in which that is no longer so.
Just to go on with that, you mentioned a quote which really interested me when you said waiting for death without eagerness or something of the sort.
Without eagerness.
While I listened to that, I sort of was contrasting it to waiting eagerly for death, which is, you know, the sort of poetic way of putting it. Mm. So I thought this, to take up Paul's point of passivity, you know, this concept, I wonder how much relationship there is between the Hindu concept, particularly the devotional way, and the and this Jain. Can you sort of compare them? Because I was trying to see, in the devotional way, the concept of passivity is taken into account, but also of activeness through actions like theatre, for example. So I wonder, can you elaborate further on this comparative?
Mm-hmm. The Jains have adopted, been influenced by Hindu devotional thinking, as they have by lots of other currents in Hindu religious thinking. And so the literary forms and indeed practices of the Bhakti Renaissance and rise of devotionalism in Hinduism influenced Jainism a lot. There's lots of instances of people writing in similar idioms, of practices of very similar forms being adopted. It's almost always the case that Jain teachers emphasize that this is to be regarded as a lower way, as it were, a way that's accessible to more people, that's easier to adopt, and so forth, and at best a transitional stage, not a high realization of union with the Godhead in the way that it's seen in the Hindu idiom, but is a sort of set of practices accessible to a multitude and should at best be a prelude to the adoption of much more restrained, individual, disciplined, self-sacrificing austerity.
That's interesting, because you're linking it to in a certain sense, you're linking it to martyrdom. No, now if we make a parallel, you'd almost think that the martyrs were happy to go towards their death. And here there is a sort of acceptance rather than joy, in a certain sense. Now, this acceptance, the way I envisage the action is one is going towards and the other is waiting for it to come towards you.
Although you're also taking action which you know will propel you in that direction by not eating and so forth, although it's important that those actions are always figured as non-actions, they're restraints and not rather than active things that you do. You go around expect, because anything you actively did would be an act of violence. So the only kind, this is, as it were, a resolution of the general paradox for Jainism, that the only kind of action that isn't violent and therefore sinful is non-action, and how you make actions from non-actions and vice versa.
Which again, I think is quite, I've noticed this, although no scholar of Hinduism by no means, but I've noticed this. I remember once we had a conversation and we kind of agreed that stasis is seen as the culmination of a life of success in India.
Yeah, in general, yes.
So it's very successful people who have made money or who have had very good careers. At the end of their life, instead of being very active, they achieve a form of stasis where they do absolutely nothing. They have people doing
But everyone runs around them.
Yes, exactly. So instead of ending life with a flourish of activity, as it were, they bring it to a close by means of stasis. So I think in that sense, of course, Jainism, as you said, it's a first cousin of Hinduism. So I have David Zamit, a colleague.
I was, most of the comparisons you seem to make with the West
related, I thought, to ideas about euthanasia and about the good life. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about the extent to which our ideas of a good death, particularly, find their way into policy debates. And I'm wondering whether the real parallels, or whether more interesting parallels, could not be found if one were to look at the discourse of self-help and self-empowerment, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, increasingly emerging as a dominant political discourse in neoliberalism. And I'm wondering whether you really made a kind of, whether you pursued this distinction between self-renunciation and self-empowerment, mm-hmm. Whether you think it's fruitful, and really whether you are, how your work also relates to that of people like, you know, Louis Dumont and Jonathan Perry, mm-hmm. who are very interested in trying to look at the way in which the political domain in the West relates to the religious domain in India.
Gosh, I hadn't thought of seeing as a parallel to these Jain religious suicides, as it were, a neoliberal entrepreneur. But it's an interesting thought. I mean, of course, you're right that as much as the point I was making about euthanasia was precisely that even those who argue in favour of it do so only as a recuperative palliative at the end of a life, not as a form of self-empowerment and so forth. And in that sense, it's different from this Jain practice. So that in that sense, it would be useful to think of models and idioms of self-empowerment as possible points of comparison with this, rather than, as it were, being fixated on the fact that it ends in death. Whether neoliberal ones would be the right one to start with, I'm not so sure.
Because what I'm most struck with is the contrast. I mean, I can see what David is getting at, but I think what is usually stressed is the reinvention of the self, which does imply some kind of negation of a self you want to get away with, which I think might have been ethically theorized more by Derek Parfit, no? A form of utilitarian ethical theory. But it seems to me that it's the contrast, because you are trying to reincarnate yourself.
And indeed, the conception, it's tied to conception of individuality as distinctiveness and uniqueness and a realization of a self that's distinctive and different and creative in a way that no other self is exactly. Whereas in this case, there's a clear conceptual distinction between the soul, and in that sense the self which will be liberated and saved, but which in doing so becomes exactly like every other soul that is so perfected. That this kind of individuation involves the abolition of differences from other such perfected individuals. And that, I mean, that's where Dumont, to go back to the second part of your question, is right, or at any rate what he describes also describes this Jain idiom, that individualism in a Western sense is entirely absent here, that what is aimed at is a self that by becoming perfect becomes self-annihilating. Annihilating.
There's a sense in which your response to that question gives me some light on another kind of question I wanted to ask. I was very struck in your paper at how you talked about the Jain notion of fasting to death as being an act of self-purification. It didn't seem to be other-regarding. Whereas among the Hindus, the act of fasting to death or fasting was an act of moral suasion. So that there's a question here of communication. There's a sort of a reference here to different theories of communication. And on the surface, it looked to me as if the Hindu notion of sacrifice, fasting, perhaps suicide, involves communicating with others in society, whereas the Jain notion is very intensely individualistic. But actually what you're saying now is that that is from a Western point of view, where communication is regarded as an act between discrete beings, whereas you're dealing with a notion of community, which is very different from a Western notion of community. It's based upon a concept of emptiness, really, where at some level of their theory, individuals should not exist, should be effaced. So yes, the notion of communication, which would emerge in a Jain theory of sacrifice, might be different. Getting back to Runyer's first question, might be very different from the notion of discourse, which would exist in a Christian theory of sacrifice. Something.
It doesn't preclude here the individual acting as exemplar, which others emulate, and in that sense, there's an indirect act of communication. But communicating with others certainly shouldn't be the objective in this case. That it should be self-regarding, in the way described.
I think we shall probably have time for just one or two very, very small questions, because it's quarter past eight. Quarter to eight. Victor, yes?
I'm just sort of comparing this community with Greece, Vasilikos, if I'm getting the name right, the work of Theodosopoulos, right? And it's pretty much the opposite, actually. On one hand, you have the Jains, which believe that sort of the more passive you are with land and everything, the better it is, the less you harm them. On the other side, you have the Greek community, which says the more you neglect it, that means you're leaving it in a state of anarchy. Can you maybe elaborate a bit more on the state of passivity? I mean, we're talking about leaving the fruit falling out of the tree. And if we're talking about letting your body decay, if necessary, in order to, you know, get rid of the karma and everything. Mm-hmm. But is the notion of neglect and passivity on all aspects sort of their life, or is it focused on some points or not the other?
You're absolutely right there. The first thing to say is these values are taken very, very seriously, so that the idea that you should neglect the body in the end is taken very seriously and embraced, and they don't shy away from the sense in which that can produce what looks to the unenlightened eye as to be ugliness and so forth. However, it's also the case that these values that I've described, this pursuit of self-purification, exists in particular for lay Jains in counterpoint with a set of other values which are consistently regarded as lower but nevertheless are embraced, and which nevertheless most people spend much more of their time living by than they spend living by these values of self-destruction. So that most lay Jains also think that looking after your family is a good thing to do. It's just it's not the highest good thing to do, and you might well, particularly in later life, renounce it. A fairly obvious reconciliation of these is, you know, you look after your family, you bring up your children at the point at which they can take over, you then renounce all further responsibilities, and in some cases all further contact with them. You might go off and never see them again and so forth, to pursue your self-purification and neglect of the self, but having actually made sure that what you leave behind you is a fully up and running family that will reproduce itself and so forth. So that for people who wish to live a life simultaneously by both much more worldly values of love and nurture and possession of wealth and so forth. I mentioned right at the beginning that there's an apparent paradox here. One of the ways in which it's resolved is that values which are in direct contrast and aesthetic counterpoint to each other can be lived either in sequence or indeed in alternation, so that people will spend periods of their life when they fast, but a very characteristic termination of one of these fasts, which are informed by these values of self-purification leading towards self-destruction, is at the end of it your family throws a great big party in which everyone celebrates it and celebrates the fact that that kind of display of self-control is also an index of reliability in material relations in the world. Somebody who can control themselves, in particular someone whose wife can show that she can control herself, is someone it's safe to do business with.
We have to remember these are very worthy people.
Absolutely.
Yes. I mean, I got to know quite a few Jains in Bombay. They're all, I would say, all wealthy, but very much involved in business activities. Yep. I think we should stop there, because of course, in true anthropological fashion, we all invite you to. We invite you all to join us for a nice plate of pasta. I cannot make it sound too attractive because it's a small restaurant, so if you all take up our offer, we're in trouble. But as I said, you're all invited.
And a glass of Guinness given it's St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you again, James Laidlaw. We look forward to tomorrow's lecture.
Thanks so much.
You have listened to Work in Progress, a series of seminars on understanding cultural diversity.